This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Ten years ago, Radio EcoShock heard from many peak oil experts predicting oil would run out within a few years and the price would skyrocket beyond our ability to afford it. That didn't happen yet in North America for two reasons. One, consumer demand in many Western countries dropped as vehicles and other fossil fuel burners responded with more efficient products, and people cut back on non-essential travel. Two, hydraulic fracturing of rock, fracking, produced a small tidal wave of natural gas, which has replaced oil in some functions, like heating and electric generating plants. This all happened despite a falling price of oil and overproduction for domestic and market reasons by major oil-producing countries. Now the energy demon has returned for the United Kingdom. A new study published by the Edinburgh Geological Society finds the UK's oil and gas reserves, quote, will run out within a decade. And the lead author is Professor Roy Thompson from the University of Edinburgh School of Geosciences. Roy Thompson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Your report asks, can fracking for gas and oil power the Scottish economy? Does your research allow you to talk about the oil and gas situation for all of the UK, including Britain, for example?
Yes, since doing the work for the Edinburgh Geological Society, I've extended it by looking at the whole of the UK, looked at different areas in the north and the Midlands of England, and also looked into the amount of gas and oil that's likely to be remaining on the continental shelf surrounding the whole of Britain.
Well, just to orient us for those who are not in the UK, how self-sufficient in energy was the UK during its North Sea oil and gas heyday?
Well, Britain has been very well endowed with energy resources for hundreds of years. So originally coal powered the British Empire for, yes, many hundreds of years. It peaked, production in coal peaked around about the time of the First World War, and then it's gradually declined until it essentially all came to an end in the era of Maggie Thatcher. The other energy resource we've had, particularly in Scotland, is we had the world's very first petrochemical industry, and that was based on oil shales, and that started in the 1850s. Again, the resource was exploited, peak production in the First World War, and that came to an end in 1964. And then, as you say, Britain since the 70s has been really lucky in that we've had some giant oil fields found on the continental shelf, and they have been providing the whole of our energy resource, even giving us resources we could export. And that went on through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, peaked in 1999. And then since then, both oil and gas have been gradually declining. And what I've been finding is that our production rates are much higher than the rates at which we're now finding oil and gas. And so it's fairly simple to me to demonstrate they'll only last for maybe a decade or so.
How can such large oil fields as discovered in the North Sea run out?
Well, the world's resources are limited. And in the same way that our coal has run out and that our oil shales have run out, although they are absolutely giant fields, developed countries just need vast amounts of energy. And so we use it at this incredible rate nowadays that resources that would have seemed large in the 1970s are at their end of their life.
You know, in American states like Colorado, let's talk about fracking. They allow fracking rigs to operate right next door to schools or in the middle of residential suburbs. The pollution is huge, but hey, money and energy appear to trump all. That seems unlikely in the UK, doesn't it?
Well, yes, for two reasons, I think. People are perhaps more worried about the environment here. But also what I've found is that the geology in the UK doesn't match with those of US shale gas areas. And this isn't really the story that has been given to people in the United Kingdom and in Scotland. The story they've been given is that there are huge reserves of gas in the ground, but I don't see the geological match at all. And the reason I've got involved in this recently is that here in Scotland, the Scottish Government has a moratorium on the fracking at the moment, and in the next few weeks, it's going to have to take a decision as to whether it wants the moratorium to continue or not. The other thing in Scotland is we have the idea that we'd like to break away from the United Kingdom and have independence, and the Scottish National Party told the public at the time of the last independence referendum that Scotland was set for a new oil bonanza heralding a new golden age, and the Prime Minister Alex Salmond said there can be little doubt that Scotland is moving into a second oil boom. So again, I've looked at that independently, and my conclusion is that actually a second oil boom simply won't be coming.
Well, I have to make a disclaimer here. I come from a long line of Scots with family in Aberdeen.
Well, I come from a long line of Scots as well.
All right. You know, the other factor, there's so many factors here, but in the United States, there are continual revelations of the financial unsustainability of fracking. Wells are so short-lived, you need to keep drilling tens of thousands of them. A vast tower of debt is building up through promotion in Wall Street or in the UK, in the city. What's the financial picture for the fracking industry in Scotland?
So the Scottish Government is about to come to this decision. It commissioned six separate reports on fracking in Scotland, the geology, the likelihood of earthquakes, the finances. And the finances report came to the conclusion, which I just find incredible, is that the whole of the Midland Valley of Scotland, an area of about 100 by 100 miles, can be fracked from 20 pads. And my calculations are that we would need thousands of wells in order to generate a decent, viable shale gas industry. So that seems to me to be a complete mismatch between what the public understands here and the experiences that you've been talking about as to how wells simply have to keep on being drilled in order to keep the production going, because fracking is completely different from conventional oil and gas. Well, the North Sea has lasted 45 years or so, but as you say, typical shale wells in many regions are exhausted after 5 or so years.
Well, the other thing I think people may not realize there that we've seen in the United States and Canada is once they drill these wells, at first the production is very poor. So for the first week or two, they just leave them open with all kinds of exhaust gases and the toxic chemicals that they've tossed down in there. It's a very polluting industry. You have trucks running down the roads 24/7. There's just so much to it that people may not realize until they're your neighbors and you wish they weren't.
That's right. And so here, gas is looked on with great favour because it's felt to be a much cleaner source than coal in terms of its global warming potential. But as you've just mentioned, that calculation is really just done on all the gas that's recovered and sold commercially. It doesn't take into account all the leakage and the venting that goes on when the wells are being completed, and it often doesn't take into account transportation. For example, if the gas has to be compressed into a liquid to transport it in tankers.
Oh, that's another whole operation. We were sold that on two consecutive elections here in British Columbia that we would have LNG plants, the liquid natural gas plants, built in our north. They would create all kinds of jobs. The Malaysian government was going to pay for all this, billions and billions of dollars. It never happened, and it's not going to happen.
Yes, so, I mean, this is my vision for the UK, is that within little more than a decade, the oil and the gas will be essentially gone. Fracking won't work because the geology doesn't allow it to. And so instead, we're going to have to import all of our gas. And so we are going to have to face these problems that you are seeing, but we're not really preparing well for it because people just haven't actually grasped that the oil, offshore oil and gas industry is coming to an end. So my view is that this is the time for the UK government to make a bold transition to renewables, because otherwise the UK's economy will soon almost have to be powered completely by imported oil and gas.
Well, and there's many sides to that coin, and one of them is, who are you getting that oil and gas from? We look at how Germany is kind of over the barrel, if you want to say, from their gas imports from Russia. They're scrambling to find some way to be not so dependent on Russia for heat in the winter. We don't want the UK to be in that position.
Well, we will be, because Russia is one source. Another source is Algeria. Another source is Qatar. The one area that is likely to continue to have gas here is Norway. They happen to have, although their fields are adjacent to ours in the North Sea, their geology is just a little bit different, so they have bigger fields which last for longer, and so they will maybe go on for another couple of decades or so. But of course, as you say, Germany is keen to get oil from and gas from other places than Russia. So they too will be wanting Norwegian supplies.
I know that the government in London is promoting the construction of new nuclear power plants. Are there commercial reactors in Scotland? And will Scots choose nuclear as the answer to these problems?
Well, yes, there are still nuclear power plants running in Scotland, but there aren't any planned to be built at the moment. Much, much more likely is that Scotland will go down a renewables route. The price of energy from offshore wind farms has reduced remarkably in the last year, and Scotland is quite a windy place. We actually have the best wind potential in the whole of Europe, particularly in the offshore areas. These offshore areas are rather deep water, but it's becoming more and more possible to use them for wind farms.
What is the Helm Review and where does that fit into this picture?
Yes, yeah, so Dieter is an economist and he's been asked by the British government to prepare a report on the future of power in Britain. Dieter's got some excellent textbooks out that he's written in the last couple of years, and so one can make an educated guess that he will follow the same line in his report, which is due next month in October, as he's been promoting in his textbooks. So he is really keen on the idea of fracking and using gas and electrifying everything. And the electricity will come from burning gas. And so it's, to me, it's very worrying that the UK government is getting advice saying that gas is the future, and yet my research suggests that actually the amount of homegrown gas that we can get from either continuing to exploit offshore reserves or from fracking is going to be really minimal. My view on fracking is that it might work in a few places in the English Midlands, near the coast in Lancashire and Yorkshire, but that it will never be on the scale that it has been in Canada and the US, and it might, there might be a few hundred wells or a few thousand wells, and it'll more resemble a cottage industry than an industry that can deliver energy to the whole of Great Britain.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Professor Roy Thompson from the University of Edinburgh. He says oil and gas production is doomed by decline there. Will the UK running out of energy happen rather suddenly at a certain point of time, or is it just going to creep in year by year?
Well, no, it's the production from offshore is plummeting. And so, of course, there will be a sort of the production will tail off a little bit, but basically it's going to be gone within 10 years or so. And it's the same for Scotland, that we'll go on continuing using motor cars, heating our homes by gas, and so we will simply have to import it. And then, well, you've got to pay for it. And you have to, and we have Brexit as well to worry about as to what our balance of payments will look like. I can see us going back to the time of the 70s when the coal was starting to run out before oil came. Britain had huge balance of payment problems in the 70s with the IMF being called in, with miners' strikes and so on. And I think people have just got used to the bonanza of North Sea oil and gas, and they simply are not wondering how they can cope for the situation when we have to import so much.
Well, it's like getting an inheritance, and your banker says, you know, it's starting to run out, and you keep on living the way you've been.
That's right, but we do have the possibility of changing now, looking for somebody else to give us an inheritance. And to me, that is the renewables industry. By combining particularly offshore wind with solar, by getting better storage systems, we've got experts here in Edinburgh on tidal energy. We've got experts here on carbon capture and storage. So really, Scotland has a bright future, but you have to plan for it because all these things take a long time to come in because they have to be such large plants and investments.
I do recall when staying in London at some of the cheaper hotels I could barely afford, I noticed there wasn't much insulation. There were many single-pane windows. There were some tragically cold bathrooms. Has that changed, and has it changed enough?
Well, now that's a good point you raise, and this brings us back to Dieter Helm's review and Dieter Helm's textbooks. And Dieter's view is that we don't need to insulate. We don't need to reduce the amount of energy we use. He's an economist, so he likes to see the demand increase because he thinks that will help people invest in new industries that are producing electricity cheaply. So that, it is thought, is absolutely not going to be in the government's plans. There won't be public schemes for helping with insulation, helping with energy efficiencies.
Well, we did have that program in Canada for a long time. The national government granted homeowners part of the cost of adding insulation to their homes or the purchase of energy-efficient furnace replacements, and it worked. Our energy consumption went down.
Yes.
Yeah.
That seems like a very sensible way forward. I mean, I think we're going to continue to burn oil and gas, although we'll be bringing it in from abroad. And so we will be continuing to contribute to global warming. We are still signed up to Paris, so we have to sort of try to square this energy trilemma, if you like, of that you need to provide energy cheaply, you need to provide security of supply, but also you need to try to do it without causing climate change. And somehow you have to produce a balance somewhere in the middle between all of those three. I mean, my view is that there's an excellent economic way of trying to do that by using market economics, but to nudge the market economics slightly, and to do that through the use of a carbon rebate. So this is the policy that's widely advocated by Jim Hansen. And, I mean, my understanding is that this is essentially the scheme that British Columbia uses to try to help reduce its carbon emissions. the idea that is that there is, yes, a carbon tax, but all of that tax comes back directly to citizens, possibly in terms of tax rebates. And then it's just that it's the magic hand of Adam Smith, who was a Scot. And so his invisible hand just works by itself then as a force that helps the demand and supply of goods in a free market reach equilibrium. And so this seems to me to be a very good system for trying to tackle this problem of where you should reside in this trilemma of providing energy cheaply, but without too big an impact on climate change.
Well, I could talk on at length about the carbon tax here in British Columbia. I was almost ignorant about it. It's almost invisible here. You don't realize there's other taxes you're paying at the gas pump, and this is a small one. And it turns out I do get $50 or $100 every year back in my tax rebate from that. And so I think what has to happen is the carbon tax itself has to be raised more. We almost had a leftist party, if you can believe it, try and cancel that carbon tax as a popular item, and they were defeated. So now they're back in power in a coalition with the Greens. It's a very mixed up scene, but I hope we can hold on to it and keep it going, because we are one of the few jurisdictions, as you mentioned in an email, that is actually doing it.
That's right. And so the idea is that you start off with a low tax so it doesn't create an immediate economic shock, and you just gradually increase it and increase it. And of course, you need other countries to also be doing something similar. They might not necessarily be using the carbon fee rebate. They might be using other systems by putting a cap on. Eventually, it will have the effect of encouraging renewables rather than burning oil and gas. And then at that stage, the tax can be reduced. And as you say, it's not something that you might notice is happening, but this is one of the great things of it, that it's just invisibly, just through people's normal behavior of deciding what to do, that you might notice your heating bills are higher than you would have expected because of the carbon tax, so you turn the thermostat down. You might notice that gas prices are a bit higher, so you decide to walk to work that day. It's just there in the part and parcel of the way people operate.
Well, in this opportunity for renewables, you also mentioned the climate problem. We just had a top scientist tell our listeners that we are creating a climate catastrophe. So maybe it's a good thing if the people in the United Kingdom realize, if they do, that their energy supplies are limited and go with renewables faster than other countries. What do you think?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I've also worked on trying to figure out how big climate change impacts will be. And I find that it is a real problem. Climate change, it's happening now. Humans have caused global warming by the burning of fossil fuels. And I find if we just follow business's usual policies, that it'll lead to huge climate change. I'm expecting that if we don't do anything, if we don't switch to renewables, that by the end of the century, carbon dioxide will have caused temperatures to be 8 degrees above pre-industrial over the land. Really, people haven't grasped that message yet. They're hoping, well, maybe we'll be able to cope if the temperature's 1.5 or 2 degrees above pre-industrial. But really, the world hasn't woken up to how much it needs to do to actually keep temperatures down to a reasonable level.
Well, and we just had major storms on this side of the pond, including almost wiping out a couple of British protectorates in the Caribbean. Islands just flattened, one island not run by Britain, but an island totally evacuated. We don't know when or if people will be able to go back and live there. Very serious storms that are changing the geography of the Caribbean, and certainly cost over $100 billion in Texas, the Hurricane Harvey there. So we're seeing some sort of extra juice going into these storms. I think it's climate change, but there's more science to be done to absolutely nail that down.
That's right. So I used to lecture on hurricanes, And my view is actually that it isn't straightforward. We don't really know how the climate system will play out in terms of hurricanes, whether they'll be stronger, whether there'll be more of them, whether they'll follow different tracks. But one little bit of physics we do know about is the so-called Clausius-Clapeyron equation, which tells us how much extra water vapor we get in the atmosphere for every 1 degree rise in temperature. And the more water vapor there is, the more damage the hurricanes will do. But it's not all that great. So at the moment, temperatures have maybe risen about a degree since pre-industrial, and that will only have put some 5% extra water into the atmosphere. So my feeling is that, yes, there is a contribution from global warming, but it's only about 5% of the total rainfall or the wind speed that you have.
Well, 5% is quite a bit when you're talking about these volumes.
If you're close to a limit and sea level is coming up.
Well, if you've got water up to your nose and you get an extra 5%, you're under, mate. Look, getting back to your own home country as we wrap up here, does someone have a program or a plan of how Scotland can transition to clean, renewable energy?
I haven't seen a good plan because I think the Scottish Government is still under the impression that they will be able to go independent and that there will be oil and gas out there, or that they will get gas from fracking. So I think we're in a really difficult position here, that the ruling party sadly haven't got the message that the Earth's resources don't last forever. We need to use what we have wisely and efficiently. And that message that resources don't last forever hasn't yet sunk in.
After a few decades as rich producers, the UK is running out of oil and gas, according to a new report from our guest, Professor Roy Thompson, from the University of Edinburgh School of Geosciences. You can find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Roy, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.